Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Venezuela. Mainstream media in the United States and Europe are giving Venezuela a round of negative press on the state of its economy. And Venezuela's President Maduro is being portrayed as a paranoid incompetent. What is really going on with Venezuela's economy? Our guest is Mark Weisbrot, writer for The Guardian newspaper and over 500 other newspapers around the world, and co-director of the Washington, D.C. based Center for Economic and Policy Research. And as world governments meet on climate change in Warsaw, Poland, and in the context of the superstorm where entire regions of the Philippines is destroyed and over 22,000 missing. For this week's Earth Watch, we speak with Tom Goldtooth, executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. And film director John Sayles has a brand new movie, Go Four Sisters. We speak with two stars of the film, Lisa Gay Hamilton and Yolanda Ross. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. The USS George Washington aircraft carrier has arrived in the Philippine Sea near the Gulf of Leyte to assist in the relief effort following last week's deadly Typhoon Haiyan. Desperately needed aid is starting to reach some of the hundreds of thousands of people in the Philippines who were displaced by the typhoon. Philippine soldiers on trucks were distributing rice and water today as crews with chainsaws removed debris from blocked roads. But many people in more isolated regions still have received no help 1 week after the typhoon hit. The United Nations estimates more than 11 million people were affected and 800,000 displaced. Marishi Mercado is a spokesperson for the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF.
There are very, very many areas that we haven't reached yet. The Philippines is a... There are over 7,000 islands in the Philippines. It's a very coastal population. Most people live on the coast, and it's hard to reach these people even in normal circumstances. Right now, it is that much harder.
Tacloban saw its first mass burial today. 100 bodies in black bags were lowered into graves. The Obama administration has announced that just 26,794 people enrolled for health insurance during the first flawed month of operations for the federal healthcare.gov website. More than 79,000 enrolled in the 14 states with their own websites. The nationwide number of 106,000 October signups was barely a fifth of what officials had projected, and a small fraction of the millions who have received widely publicized private coverage cancellations as a result of the federal law. Some Democrats now are seeking changes in the signature program. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has scheduled a meeting today between Democratic lawmakers and White House health care officials to discuss the issue. Republican House Speaker John Boehner has announced the House of Representatives will not hold formal compromise talks on the Senate-passed comprehensive immigration bill. It was a fresh blow to immigration reform advocates and families torn apart by deportations.
We've made it clear that we're going to move on a common sense, step-by-step approach in terms of how we deal with immigration. The idea that we're going to take up a 1,300-page bill that no one had ever read, which is what the Senate did, is not going to happen in the House. And frankly, I'll make clear, we have no intention of ever going to conference on the Senate bill.
Boehner's statement made clear there is no remaining chance the House would pass immigration legislation before year's end and cast further doubt on the prospects for comprehensive reform in 2014. Earlier this week, a small coalition of immigration activists began a fast. Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
We have heard the word wait in the past. Dr. King heard it. Chavez heard it. Gandhi heard it. Our communities of immigrants continue to hear it while they bear witness to families divided by deportations. students trapped in limbo, bearing the weight of anxiety beyond their years, and workers brutally exploited and relegated to near invisibility. Yet, like them, we refuse to dwell on the frustration of wait.
The Obama administration is on track to surpass 2 million deportations since taking office in 2009. Many advocates are calling on Obama to use executive power to end or greatly reduce the deportations. Janet Yellen, President Obama's nominee to lead the Federal Reserve, thinks the U.S. Central Bank has more work to do to help an economy and a labor market that are still struggling. In remarks prepared for delivery at a confirmation hearing today, Yellen said supporting the recovery is the surest path to returning to a more normal approach to monetary policy. Yellen's testimony appeared aimed in part at preempting Republicans on the panel who are critical of the Fed's aggressive monetary policy. If confirmed by the Senate, Yellen would be the first woman to lead the central bank. Boeing machinists in Washington soundly have rejected an 8-year labor contract extension. Boeing has threatened to build key parts of a new 777X jet in a non-union state or overseas if union workers rejected the contract. The no vote was 67%. A Boeing executive said the company was disappointed and would have, quote, no choice but to pursue all options for the new jetliner. Boeing wanted to end the traditional pension plan and increase union workers' health care costs. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And as governments meet yet again, they've made very little progress in any of their previous meetings on climate change. For this week's Earth Watch, I'd like to welcome back to Sojourner Truth, Tom Goldtooth. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for the invite.
Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network and member of the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change, the Indigenous Caucus within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So there's a meeting going on now in Warsaw. There's preparation for a meeting in Doha. The context, of course, is the tragic storm that has hit the Philippines, and 22,000 people are reported missing. And a delegate from the Philippines actually broke ranks, I think, with said that people should not just follow their masters in government, but really think of people who are being impacted by climate change, and made quite an emotional appeal. So, Tom Goldtooth, give us your take on what you think is going on at the meeting in Warsaw, Poland, and you've also made a statement on it.
Yes, our organization did. Unfortunately, I'm not in Warsaw at this time, but we do have people on the ground there who are reporting, you know, almost like every hour. Again, you know, we're really expressing our deepest sadness and our support to the people in the Philippines. And, you know, our spiritual leaders, in fact, you know, have been meeting from the north and the south, you know, to bring attention to the reality that something needs to change, that Mother Earth is doing everything that she needs to do to put. And this typhoon is just one of those issues. Unfortunately, in Warsaw, at this conference of the parties, negotiating texts on making commitments, you know, to address the issues of reduction of greenhouse gas emission is not on the agenda. There's no negotiating text for that. I like to say it's not all about money. But it is about money. It is about funding. And even though funding is needed, that there's other pressing issues. And, you know, our concern in Warsaw right now is that, you know, it's the U.S. and the European Union's agenda to scale up carbon trading mechanisms and to, continue this whole path of unsustainable development and continuing business as usual. with our fossil fuel economy. I mean, that's the problem we're in.
Yeah, and you know, I understand that you are not in Warsaw, and in fact, I wanted to talk with you a little about that. I was at a conference recently in Tucson, Arizona. Ann Peterman, executive director of the Global Justice Ecology Project, with whom we partner for our weekly Earth Watch, was there and talked about some of the problems in working within the framework of these UN conferences, and not a whole heck of a lot seems to happen in these UN conferences, despite all of the dire warnings that Mother Earth herself seems to be sending us. However, you do work also, not only in a grassroots level, but also within the UN framework. So tell us a little bit about that tension.
Sure. You know, within our indigenous network, we've grown from our work here in the United States, Canada, and Alaska, and now working globally with indigenous communities. And, you know, some of our constituency here in the United States are, you know, concerned tribal governments trying to plan a future for their people. So climate change is a very critical issue, and with us and our network, it's one of our top concerns. And, you know, we looked at the bigger picture. I mean, we as Native, as indigenous peoples from the belly of the beast here in the United States, we have a long history with treaty negotiations with the United States. We've had people that go on the Hill to lobby, to push the envelope as much as we can to obtained, you know, recognition of our treaty rights, you know. So globally, you know, there's not much difference in that scenario. And we strategically look at this picture to where we need to be on the inside as indigenous peoples. We need to be putting a face to these issues, a rights-based approach. But also we see value in an outside strategy. You know, bringing the grassroots people in, lifting up our voices, and that's part of a need for a global movement to really bring attention to what is not taking place in these UN negotiations. Because, you know, from my participation, you know, you're dealing with the big powers of economic globalization, energy companies, and the industrialized developed countries, and lurking in that background are the financial sectors, the world banks, you know, the investors of capital. And, you know, we think that it's very dangerous when we bring these issues up on the inside, you know, issues like rights issues, issues of governance and transparency, because the same issues that we face in this country actually is magnified on a global level when we try to bring in civil society, especially those people that come from vulnerable communities, whether it's our indigenous peoples from the Arctic or whether it's our indigenous peoples from Latin America or Africa, but also the peasants and the small farmers as well, that we have been somewhat systematically locked out from expressing our views. And, you know, Anne, in fact, was, you know, attacked in one of the previous UN meetings in Durban just for speaking up.
Yeah, and I mean, the Indigenous Environmental Network and other Indigenous people around the world, I know that you are in touch with other Indigenous peoples across the world, have been bringing this message again and again and again to world governments. And I wonder, we know that the Western governments, in particular the United States, has been problematic in blocking some of what you would like to see happen and to really halt climate change. Are there any, I mean, what kind of response are you getting from other governments? Are there any governments that you're finding that are more open to this and that are working with you beyond the governments that are most threatened, like the island nations?
Yeah, that's right. You know, there was a turning point to some degree a couple of years ago in Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
In Copenhagen was a UN climate meeting. They happen annually. In Copenhagen, Bolivia, which is headed up by an indigenous leader, Evo Morales, actually, you know, started to put on the table, you know, these concerns of fault solutions. And it was alarming when we saw in the middle of the night when Bolivia was trying to make interventions, putting forward real solutions to this issue of climate change, that the chair was not recognizing the representative of Venezuela and Bolivia, and they had to literally beat the name plaque of their country on the table, and the woman from Venezuela's hand were bleeding. This was some really extreme politics going on when our president Obama appeared and started to negotiate with China and other countries, completely separate from mandates that were negotiated at previous UN meetings in Bali. And so, you know, that really was something that was really obvious to many people there, that there's a bigger agenda here at stake, and it concerns capitalism. And that's why Bolivia took a lead with some other Latin American countries and small island states to have an alternative meeting. And that happened that April 2010 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, at the World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth. We were there. There were 30 to 35,000 people there. And some countries were there as well, concerned about this issue. And I think we elevated this issue, that really what we're dealing here with the systems change, not climate change, that we have to reclaim our future, that we have to change the present system that we're in. And that's kind of what our articulation is, and also something that's very radical. And that is that something that as Native, as Indigenous peoples have always been saying, is that the world has to, you know, reevaluate its relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth. And we have to, you know, recognize our responsibilities, you know, to the natural laws of Mother Earth, to nature, and that, you know, that the capitalist system has exploited and abused nature. And right now is privatizing nature as part of its green economy agenda that a number of us, including Anne's organization and many others, when we came to Rio Plus 20 last year to say that is not a solution.
Right. And Tom Goldtooth, it just so happens that in the segment right after this one, we'll be talking about Venezuela, which has been getting a lot of really bad press recently. But as an Indigenous person, part of the Indigenous Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, I know that countries like Venezuela, as well as Bolivia, have come, and some other countries in Latin America that are seen to be, quote unquote, progressive countries or perhaps anti-capitalist countries in the way Venezuela, the government of Venezuela is right now, and Bolivia, for, you know, their dependence on, for the economy, on things like oil. And it seems to be, people seem to have the view that, well, because they are extracting oil or gas, that then they have to be opposed as a government. Or, I mean, how do you walk that balance, I should say?
Well, first of all, you know, what we're asking for, you know, in our network, and that's in consultation with our spiritual leaders, is that mankind has really lost its relationship to Mother Earth, and that's part of industrialization.
Yeah.
if we don't have that understanding of what that relationship is, and for us it's a spiritual relationship, and if we don't have that, we have no ethics and policies that we develop. Then we become dominated by an economic system then that exploits nature but also exploits human beings. That's why, you know, we're trying to make that shift in consciousness away from a property rights regime that has been developed as a mechanism of capitalism to a mechanism that recognizes the rights of Mother Earth, looking for Earth jurisprudence. So it's not going to be easy. I personally have had discussions with Presidente Evo Morales about these challenges. You know, some of these contracts that they negotiated had been negotiated before his position as president.
Mm-hmm.
And there also is some other extremes in his country, you know, with right and left and politics. And when I was down there, you know, I was I saw a lot of the concerns of indigenous peoples about mineral extraction, for an example.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, as an example, that has legislated language on rights of nature, is that these are steps that countries, governments have to move towards. And sure, there will be some contradictions. But if we don't have an informed public, civil society that is pushing a new agenda, and then we will find governments being manipulated by the powers of money, and that's why, you know, we have to really look at something that's going to take some time, but you know, it's something we have to try to make that shift. And in the meantime, you know, many of our communities don't have time, and that's the challenges that we have.
Right. Well, we are certainly going to continue this discussion with you and others in the Indigenous Environmental Network. We're out of time right now, but there's a lot more to discuss on this. And Tom Goldtooth, we really appreciate you joining us. Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
All righty. And on that note, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're going to go directly now to talking about Venezuela. Some of it, that discussion began in the segment on the environment, but since being elected president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, following the death of Hugo Chavez, President Nicolas Maduro, who was chosen by Chavez to take up the presidential helm, has faced a barrage of criticism from the opposition in Venezuela, as well as not only criticism, but downright disrespect on the part of mainstream media in the United States and Europe. They like to portray President Maduro as a paranoid former bus driver who doesn't have the capacity to be president. In September, due to behind-the-scenes moves by the United States, President Maduro was blocked from attending the UN General Assembly meetings held at the UN in New York City. And prior to that, he was denied permission to fly over Puerto Rico. President Maduro, picking up the legacy of Hugo Chavez, is a fierce critic of the United States, and he doesn't hesitate to expel diplomats or even journalists that are tied into undermining his government. There's been a steady round of bad press about Venezuela on the economic front. If one reads the mainstream media, one gets the impression that the economy of Venezuela is just totally falling apart. But what's really going on? So we have invited Mark Weisbrot to break it down for us. Mark, thank you for joining us. Mark, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes regularly for The Guardian, newspaper of the U.K., well-respected paper around the world. And also he writes for over 500 newspapers in different parts of the world, including for Brazil's largest newspaper. And his opinion pieces have appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and most U.S. newspapers, and he is seen on Al Jazeera and other networks. So, Mark Weisbrot, tell us what's happening here, because you've written about this, and I mean, article after article, I see one here on Tuesday, Venezuela bonds sink after Maduro moves against retailers. You know, it's just typical of the press from AP and all of them in terms of what's happening with the economy in Venezuela.
Yes. Well, I don't want to minimize the problems. I mean, they are more serious than they've been for quite a while. You know, you do have inflation running now. And if you look at the last 12 months, the consumer price index has increased 54%.
Is that new in Venezuela? I mean, is this kind of a new thing?
You had higher inflation. I mean, right before Chavez was elected, it was 100%. So it's not unprecedented, and it's not hyperinflation like the press. Actually, a good deal of the press has tried to call it hyperinflation, even though, you know, any economics textbook wouldn't call it hyperinflation. And so it isn't nearly as bad as the media is making it out. However, it is worse than it's been there, you know, probably in the last decade. You have hyperinflation, you have a black market where you have, and that's, I mean, you don't have hyperinflation, you have high inflation, and you have a black market, which is kind of driving the inflation. What happens is importers that don't can't get official dollars at the official rate, which is 6.3 bolivares to the dollar, they pay now as much as 60, and so that drives up the cost of a lot of things.
Why is that happening, Mark? I mean, is that the fault of the Maduro government, mistakes that they've made?
I think some of it is. I mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, neglect the sabotage and the media trying to convince people, for example, you know, that the black market rate is just going to, the dollar is just going to be going up and up and everybody should buy it. You know, that's kind of a bubble aspect to it. But I think what the government did do, I mean, the burst of inflation is mainly was mainly caused beginning last fall by the government not providing enough dollars for the market.
Right.
In other words, they cut it in half, and then in February of this year, they cut it out entirely. Now they started replacing it, and when they started, you know, putting dollars out there, inflation came down. It peaked at a monthly rate of 6.2% in May, and then it started to come down, you know, for about 4 months. And now it's gone back up again because of the black market. So it's a situation. I mean, it's not this situation where it's going to spiral out of control. And, you know, so that's where I would really differ from the, you know, the stuff you see in the mainstream media, which is, you know, they've been saying this for the whole last decade that Venezuela's economy was going to implode. And, of course, it did pretty well in the last decade, you know. They had income growth per person of 2.7% annually, and they had you know, reduced poverty by more than half and extreme poverty by about three quarters. And actually, just last year, the poverty rate in Venezuela dropped by 20%. And this is on the World Bank website. Anybody can find it there. And it's amazing because it's the biggest drop in poverty in the hemisphere and quite possibly the whole world. And not a single Western major media outlet has reported it yet.
Yeah, I mean, because that's the thing about it, Mark. If you look at I mean, that's quite an achievement, attacking poverty, poverty being one of the major, if not the major, along with ecological devastation, crises across the globe.
Well, 20% drop in 1 year is just, that's very, very unusual. I've never seen it before. And it's because mainly because of a cash transfer program that the government did, and also, of course, the growth in the economy and the big housing projects that they had construction that they had last year. So,
yeah.
But that, you know, getting back to the current crisis, I think it is serious. The other problem that the government has is, you know, they have enough reserves. You know, they have a lot of reserves, actually, much more than they would need in terms of dollars. But the problem is that most of the reserves are in gold, and gold is not liquid. And so that's another problem. In my opinion, they should sell that and get all their gold, all their reserves in one place, take them from the other. They have also, besides the central bank reserves, they have reserves in other government agencies like PDVSA, the National Oil Company. And I think they would do much better if they sold their gold and centralized all their reserves. But there's political pressure from all sides in Venezuela, I think, not to sell the gold. You know, it was part of their legacy of Chavez. He deliberately took a lot of their reserves from abroad and put it in gold because he didn't want the hostile countries like the U.S. or the its European allies to be able to take this. And so he brought it home. So there's that, I think, that problem. But I think that that obviously can be resolved. It's not like they really have a balance of payments crisis. Again, the media is trying to present it that way. But when you have that, you have tens of billions of dollars in gold reserves, in reserves, even if they're not liquid, that they can be sold. And so I think the crisis is going to be resolved. It's just a question when the government takes certain steps.
Yeah, and that there is the politics of it, though. I mean, I'm looking at this Reuters article, Brian Ellsworth's article on the bond sinking. And two things. One is that if you look at the economic crisis in the United States and you look at world headlines in relation to all of the problems we know has happened here, the United States wasn't really portrayed, you know, in the way that Venezuela is being portrayed now in terms of some kind of in terms of the economic crisis and the depth of it. But also there's been much to be made about the shortage of goods, including the shortage of toilet paper, you know, women in stores, you know, running around trying to hoard toilet paper. And of course, on December the 8th, there's going to be a vote for mayors in municipal elections. And traditionally in Venezuela, it seems as though prior to an election, at least during the Chavez era and the post-Chavez era, shortages tend to pop up.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of that is political. I mean, you have these huge, this Polar, the biggest food distributor in the country. I think it's got like half the market. And in the past, they have, in fact, withheld food and basic items right before elections. And then sometimes, you know, in the past elections, you see these items appear on the shelves right away, right after the election. So there's that kind of stuff, too. But I do think the main thing, I mean, you got to remember, they had until last fall, you know, and even though they were heading into two elections, they had one last October, and then they had the second presidential election in April. And but in the you know, in the run up to Chavez's election in October, you had 2 years of economic growth, and very you know, rapid economic growth. It was 5.7% in 2012, and you had inflation was falling the whole time, and so the economy is capable of having sustained growth and increased employment and the poverty reduction you saw, and at the same time containing inflation. So it isn't a problem of, you know, the government printing too much money or the economy growing too fast.
yeah.
the traditional view of inflation.
Well,
really
what steps, though, Mark?
Foreign exchange market.
Sorry, Mark. What steps has the – we have about 2 minutes left. What steps has the government taken to address the problem?
Well, I think they've definitely started supplying more. They've had these auctions now, regular auctions where they're supplying – they started supplying dollars to the market. At a rate that's higher than the official rate. It's probably around 12. It's not announced. But they have auctions where businesses and importers can get dollars. And that brought the inflation rate down, like I said, from 6.2% in May to 3.0 in August. And so that was definitely going along pretty well. And, of course, the problem is that then September and October inflation were higher,
yeah.
And that's because of the black market. So the next steps they haven't taken yet, but I think they're going to take steps to bring down the black market rate, and then you'll see the problems begin to be resolved.
Yeah, and of course, some other controversial news, bound to be controversial, by those who want any opportunity to slam the Maduro government of the decree powers won by the president on Tuesday, allowing him to issue laws without the express approval of the Venezuelan Council, Congress, and then over the weekend, President Maduro ordering soldiers and police to occupy stores of the electronics retailer DACA, forcing the company to sell goods at a lower price. So I imagine the government has its own reasons for doing this, but just final comments, Mark Weisbrot, because both of these are bound to be very controversial.
Yeah. Well, you do have a lot of retailers that are getting dollars at 6.3, and they're selling at prices that are, that are determined by exchange rate, eight times that. So they are making an enormous profit because the government is giving them cheap dollars, and that's
yeah.
what Maduro was reacting to.
Right. Well, Mark Weisbrot, we're going to continue to follow this saga, this story here. Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C., and very much an expert in the regions south of the border. Mark, when we have you back, we'll have to get to Honduras because we didn't get to it today. But thank you,
yeah,
Mark.
That would be great. The election's, I think, November 24th.
That's it. Okay. Thank you, Mark Weisbrot. We are going to take a station break, and coming up, John Sayles' brand new movie, Go for Sisters, opens in theaters in Los Angeles on Friday. It has a run also going in New York right now. Stay with us. We're going to be joined by Lisa Gay Hamilton and Yolanda Ross, two of the stars of that film.
This is Brother Cornell West, and you are listening to Sojourner Truth with host, my dear sister, Margaret Prescott.
The song is 100 Yard Dash. The artist is Raphael Sadiq. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And the brilliant and independent filmmaker John Sayles' brand new movie, Go for Sisters, opens in Los Angeles on Friday, November the 15th. And for our listeners in New York City, it is in theaters now, but is wrapping up its run there. Although billed as a thriller, which it is indeed, in true John Sayles style, moviegoers will no doubt be caught up in the relationships portrayed in the film. The multiracial cast includes Lisa Gay Hamilton, whose extensive film credits include Beloved, Campbell Scott's Hamlet, The Truth About Charlie, and many others. Also, Yolanda Ross, who can currently be seen on HBO's Tremé and is considered an actor to watch. And also in the film is the great Edward James Olmos, who has been nominated for the Tony, Emmy, and Academy Award. His breakout film was Zoot Suit. He has appeared in Blade Runner and won a Golden Globe for his role in Stand and Deliver and so many other films. Go For Sisters is a film about friendship, about the work of being a mother, about the impact of the criminalization of survival in Black and brown communities, and the harrowing tale of the risks involved in crossing the U.S. border from Mexico without papers. And it draws out the Black-brown interrelationships and the necessary working together of Black and Latino communities. The economic divide, as well as relationships forged behind prison walls. And I'd like to welcome both of our guests. I'd like to welcome actor Lisa Gay Hamilton. Lisa Gay, thank you for joining us.
Oh, Margaret, thank you so much for having us on this morning.
And also Yolanda Ross. You're in New York City. Are you Yolanda?
I am, Margaret. Good morning.
Okay, thank you. I must say, I did get to watch the film from beginning to end. Entirely fascinating, just the relationships between both of you, Lisa Gay Hamilton and Yolanda Ross, with the characters that you play. Just incredible. And of course, the great Edward James Olmos. But what I'd like to do is to, first of all, go to a clip from the film, because central, it's not the only relationship in the film that is so key, but central to the film, the relationship between your two characters, Lisa Gay Hamilton and Yolanda Ross. Let's go to that clip right now.
So, Bernice, past acquaintance between officer and client is prohibited, so after today you'll have to be reassigned. But for now, you violated your parole. Marvella coming to the diner. I hadn't seen her in some time. We got to talking. She offered to carry me home in a ride. That's all. Marvella, who has 2 warrants for her arrest. I didn't know that. Marvella, who was driving without a valid driver's license. Brenda offered you a ride. You don't ask to see no picture ID. If I was in danger of returning to prison, I wouldn't want to take any chances. I didn't know. You went to 2 bars before you were picked up.
I had club soda.
Both bars are known to be venues for narcotics transactions.
You see where I live. There ain't nothing but that. So how you been, Bernice?
All right, I guess.
His job.
Yeah.
Married?
Was.
Kids?
And a son. He was a soldier in Operation Enduring Freedom.
Wow. Grown up that much.
Mm-hmm. How you been?
You can read my jacket.
It's too long.
Well, so much captured in just that short clip. We're going to need to unpack that a bit. The Lisa Gay Hamilton plays the role of Bernice, a parole officer. Yolanda Ross playing the role of Fontaine, a woman who has had some troubles and who has been out of in and out of prison, it seems. And Bernice is her parole officer. So Bernice, Lisa Gay Hamilton, who plays the role of Bernice, unpack that for us. What was going on with what we just heard?
Well, it turns out that Bernice and Fontaine were best friends in high school. And like, you know, most friends, you know, by the time you're graduating from high school, your lives perhaps split. Ours do. I get married. I become a parole officer. And Fontaine's character hits upon some hard times, including drug addiction and being incarcerated. Lo and behold, 20 years later, I end up, by chance, being her parole officer. And so that scene is the beginning of the film and the beginning of their re-encounter after 20 years, which is difficult, obviously, for both women who, in the deepest sense of sisters, loved one another then and throughout the film discover that friendship and love is still there.
And Yolanda Ross, what quite struck me about that scene, but also throughout the film, I mean, here you started out childhood friends in high school, paths diverged. I mean, this story is such a common story in our communities and in Black communities, also brown communities. I'm sure any community, you know, where there is a, you know, impacted by an economic divide. So tell us about your character, Fontaine, Yolanda Ross.
Fontaine and Bernice were friends in school, very tight. And when they did go their separate ways, she got caught up in a lot of things, drugs and alcohol, and was in and out of prisons. And at this point, I mean, she's trying to make that change in her life. Something that, you know, is said in the movie from the characters is, you know, that she was always fond and a little jealous of Bernice's family and home life situation because it was so much different than hers. And that is something I think she's, you know, striving to get to, you know, just to make every day count because she's lost so many days, you know, as far as like her past life.
Yeah. And also, Yolanda Ross, part of what has came out in the film, you're now on very different paths. I mean, she is your parole officer. You're the one, in a way, dependent on her. But then her character, Bernice, becomes dependent on you, right? And mm-hmm. and you were mm-hmm. able to then use the relationships and the information, the kind of grassroots knowledge that you gained on the street, so to speak, and in prison to assist Bernice, who is much more on the quote-unquote professional end.
Yeah, to help my friend. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I see it. Not just a parolee and a parole officer, but helping a friend, you know, go through a whole thing as far as finding her son and, you know, dealing with the streets, knowing that she has not been a cop that has been on the streets and, you know, being protective and aiding her. That's what Fontaine really is doing. You know,
I think your insight is quite right, Margaret, in that John ever so subtly touches upon the plight of the working class person, the plight of the person who is less fortunate than the majority, let's say, so that he does brilliantly take Yolanda's character and gives you what is it like for a woman of color to come in and out of the judicial system, the criminal justice system. And then, as Fontaine's character says, you know, yes, I've broken my parole, but where else would I go? I mean, look where I live, she says. This is the community that I'm in. How can I possibly do better? How can I possibly avoid drugs and alcohol when this is all that there is? And I think John ever so subtly is giving us the taste of what a person of color, in particular a woman, would go through. And then my character, whose son is a war veteran who has begun to do some illegal things, and the illegal thing that he is doing is transporting potential Chinese immigrants into the United States through Mexico. He gives us that political framework to look at as well. And then the fact that Bernice is willing to risk her own life, potentially even risk the life of her friend and her own freedom, for not Fontaine's freedom, and even her own potentially to save her son. John really does give you the social economic background of all of these people that you wouldn't normally get to see in a commercial film, which you don't get to see. And that's why we're so grateful that you're giving us this opportunity to talk about our film, because we do feel it is that important. And obviously John Sayles is very, very important himself.
Right. And I think a reason that our audience here on Sojourner Truth, and indeed in Southern California, as well as in other cities, would be very keen on this film, because John Sayles, he does have a way of bringing in the socioeconomic conditions, a kind of a political message involved in it. And here you see people like the Lisa Gay Hamilton, the character you play, Bernice. I mean, no way a criminal, right, lived, you know, has done just about everything right. You know, the kind of job that you have, you haven't, that character hasn't fallen into trouble the way Fontaine did. And also the character of Edward James Olmos, who was a police officer who got caught up in, well, it implies in the film that perhaps he, you know, was innocent or didn't really do what he was accused of, but he was disgraced.
Certainly, in John is talking about what it is to the shield, the blue shield of honor. What happens if you choose not to break it, or if you choose to break it? And either way, as in with Edward's character, you're going to get kicked out at some point, right?
Something
bad is going to happen at some point, and that's all of us, all of our characters are trying to find redemption in some sort of way, and certainly Eddie's character is trying to do that as well.
Right, and the socioeconomic, just the conditions of what happened, you wind up being criminalized.
Right. I mean,
there you were at some point with a gun, Lisa Gay Hamilton, parole officer, shooting at somebody.
Right.
quite amazing.
But go ahead, Yolanda, give the plug for the film about the website, because we're opening around the country.
Yeah. We're opening in so many places, and there might be, you know, more theaters later on there in L.A., but we're at GopherSistersMovie.com, and it has, you know, all the information on the film and where we're opening up.
We're opening in Chicago and Boston and Atlanta and Nebraska. Yolanda will be.
I'm going next week to Nebraska.
Well, that's great, because for some of our listeners, some of our listeners in other parts of the country, I'm sure they're going to go to that website to see if you're going to be in their part of town. Give that website again for us, Yolanda.
GopherSistersMovie.com.
Yes. Okay. And just continuing our discussion about the film, in the introduction, I talked about the black-brown interrelationships, you know, in the film. And there you all are, two sisters, two black women, right? Mm-hmm. You know, going down south of the border in a very dangerous, you know, situation. And you are there with Edward James Olmos, and also there is a young woman in the film, a young Latina woman, Yolanda Ross, who apparently was somebody that your character met behind prison walls. And I also found it interesting, John Sayles, really getting into the black-brown relationships, and particularly in this part of the world, as black communities become more brown and people really have to learn to work with each other and deal with each other. But it was done really very subtly and very beautifully, and how dependent you were on each other.
That to me was one of my favorite scenes, because it was really subtle, but there was so much happening. And I mean, that's a black brown female relationship, where the people were into each other, and I thought it was a really nice extra to the film as far as the relationships.
Right. And then Lisa Gay Hamilton, I don't want to give anything away about the film. We do want people to go see it. And I would love to hear from our listeners to let me know what you think of the film after you have seen it. I'd be glad to share that with Lisa Gay and Yolanda. But also there is a bit a class divide between the two characters of Bernice and Fontaine. And then that friendship that was there and grows yet again across that class divide.
You know, I think John has really written a love story. The theme of love runs throughout the film.
Yeah.
And as, sorry for that static, and as, you know, Bernice and Fontaine were so close as friends, they could go for sisters, as all of us have those sisters in our life, that love remains. I have those kind of, you know, I call them my phone girlfriends, where, you know, from high school or from college or from earlier on in my life, and we still keep up with one another and, in fact, would actually do anything for the other person, even though distance has occurred. And you're right, John gave you two very different women from different socioeconomic backgrounds, and yet, as you have suggested, with brown, black, with humanity, we are still interdependent no matter what. And the need for love and the need for connection amongst all of us never leaves us. And,
right.
And that's the beauty of this film. I mean, the ending of the film, and like I said, I'm not getting it away, but it just reaffirms the necessity for women in particular to remain sisters in spite of what other conditions that we unfortunately don't have control of
right.
take over us and still find a way to support one another. That's
okay.
What I love about this film.
Okay, we are going to have to leave it there. Powerful film, really important. I would encourage all of our audience to just check it out, opening tomorrow, on November the 15th. Lisa Gay Hamilton and Yolanda Ross, an honor to have both of you on the show.
Margaret, we love your show. Thank you so much for
having us. All righty. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank Sherelle Withers, Michelle Lavner, our engineer Teddy Robinson, assistant producer Kevin Walker. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.